When was the first time you ever remember feeling angry? Perhaps an older or younger sibling was involved, a parent or babysitter, an uncooperative toy, or a playdate gone awry? What about a time when your anger boiled over to the point that someone observing you might have said your anger, your zeal, was all-consuming, that it engulfed you, that it practically ate you up, not to mention anyone or anything else close by? A few years ago, I had an unpleasant interaction that was wholly unexpected. I was picking up my daughter from a friend's house and had pulled over on the side of the road in front of the house waiting when a man pulled up alongside, rolled down his window, and started yelling at me to move my car. I sat behind my steering wheel, stunned and dumbfounded at his behavior, unable to get a word in to try to explain what I was doing, when I heard him shout in an accusatory and mocking tone, "And you don't even speak English." Something snapped inside of me, and before I knew it, I was out of my car, hands flailing in the air, hurling the finest English expletives that I could think of his way, along with a string of other words and impassioned sentences, something about how dare he assume, something about where I went to school, something about my lawyer, most of which I can't remember. It was not my best moment, nor, I guess, was it his. What I do remember is how utterly exhausted and spent I felt afterwards. Exhausted, spent, and sad. I wonder how Jesus felt after the temple incident described in today's gospel. Exhausted, exhilarated, spent, sad. And what about his friends and followers? Had they ever seen him that way before? Was it their first time witnessing his anger? Did it scare them, make them more tentative, perhaps, around him? Or had they experienced his anger before? And was this simply the only account we hear told of in the gospel narratives of Jesus being this overtly outraged in public? We can only imagine. But what we do have is some clue as to why Jesus' anger was all-consuming and engulfing, causing him to make such a scene, overturning tables, driving out livestock, and calling out the entire system of worship and ritual that was on full display at the temple. You see, it wasn't in fact worship and rituals that Jesus had a problem with. It was that this particular system of worship and ritual was backbreaking and unduly burdensome on God's people who were struggling the most to survive. It put enormous hoops and barriers up before the poorest, the most vulnerable, controlling access, as it were, to God's mercy and forgiveness. In this ancient system, in order for you to be right with God, sacrifices on your behalf had to be offered within the temple by the priests. And in order for sacrifices to be offered, specific unblemished animals had to be purchased by you. And in order for unblemished animals to be purchased, money had to be exchanged. You couldn't use your usual Roman currency, which featured the graven image of Caesar, who claimed to be a god, on it. So you had to exchange your Roman currency for temple coins. As one biblical commentator describes, if you were wealthy, you gave a large animal like a cow or an ox, but if you were poor, you gave doves or pigeons. To purchase one pair of doves at the temple was the equivalent of 2 days' wages. But the doves had to be inspected for quality control just inside the temple, and if your recently purchased unblemished animals were found to be in fact blemished, then you had to buy two more doves for even more days' wages. Add to this the fact that if you were an out-of-towner, which most people were, traveling from elsewhere for your yearly pilgrimage to Jerusalem for the Passover, the historian Josephus estimated up to 2.25 million people visited the Holy City for Passover each year, then you would also have to arrange and pay for lodging and food. All told, the commentator continues, a day's stay in Jerusalem during one of the three major festivals could cost between $3,000 to $4,000 in contemporary value, and you were required to attend at least one of these three festivals each year. If you had that kind of money and wealth to be able to spare and spend, you were good to go. But most people, as today, did not. Hence Jesus's anger, Jesus's outrage, Jesus's all-consuming passion, rage, and zeal. This, after all, is the same Jesus, the Jesus as portrayed through the lens of the fourth gospeler, John, the same Jesus who a couple of chapters later, we hear, encounters a Samaritan woman, the ultimate other, at a well, and engages her in conversation. And in response to her question, where is the correct place to worship God? Here on my people's holy mountain or there on your people's holy mountain? Jesus responds, the hour is coming and is now here when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father seeks such as these to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship God must worship in spirit and truth. God is spirit, and those who worship must worship in spirit and truth. This same Jesus, who speaks later on in the narrative of himself abiding in God's love, and his followers abiding in his love as branches of a vine. The ultimate question, it seems, that Jesus is getting at in this fourth gospel and pointing his followers then and now towards is, where does God abide? Where is God's dwelling place? Where is God housed? In a physical building made of stone, in a temple, in a house of worship, or in me, Jesus proclaims. And therefore in you, in the holy temple and tabernacle that is the human being, made in the very image and likeness of God. And not just in some human beings, not just those with access to wealth and money, power and privilege, not just those of a certain rank or station in life, not just those with a certain ancestry or history, color or creed who worship on this mountain or that mountain, but every human being. Our human bodies, our own flesh and blood, these incredible structures of carbon atoms and molecules, recycled stardust and ocean water, are the very living temples of God's spirit, God's consciousness, God's breath, God's heart, God's mercy, God's love. 20th century philosopher Martin Buber captures the essence of this truth when speaking of the I-thou way of being in the world. We can, as humans, choose to interact with others in a transactional way, treating others as objects, as I relating to it, or we can choose to interact with others in a relational way as I relating to thou, in the same way we relate to the holy mystery that is God. As followers of Christ here and now in the 21st century, our commitment is to strive as best we can to relate to all human beings and to our own selves in an I-thou way. In our baptismal covenant, we each promise to seek and serve Christ in all persons, loving our neighbors as ourselves, and to strive for justice and peace among all people, respecting the dignity of every human being. The season of Lent is a time when we are invited to recommit and be more intentional about this way of being, living, and relating in our world, taking care of our relationships with God, ourselves, and others, realizing that these relationships are all, in fact, interconnected and one. And realizing that we, in fact, do not need to be in a building made of stone to connect with the holy mystery that is God, because in truth, we are relating and communing with God whenever we acknowledge God's living presence in our fellow human beings and in ourselves. Amen.